legislators and others, and you are all welcome also. So with that, we will call our case, and our first attorney is James Moore, who will argue for the American National Property and Casualty Company.
Thank you, Justice Abramson. Justices, Mr. Gazurkevich, and top student, an honored guest. My pleasure to be here today to speak on behalf of American National Property and Casualty Company. And I only pray that I'm slightly more persuasive than I was the last time I was in front of the court. American National is the uninsured motorist insurer of the plaintiff respondent in this case, Christine Nyman. The court is well aware, I'm sure, of the facts of this case. This appeal challenges and raises only one issue, that is the constitutionality of the retroactive change in Wisconsin's wrongful death law. That change raised the limits that could be awarded for loss of society and companionship in wrongful death cases. But the precise issue that we're here to talk about today is whether that change may be applied retroactively or whether it is to be applied prospectively only. Namely, is the retroactive application unconstitutional? This accident occurred in September of 1995. At that point, according to 90 years of court precedent issued by this court and the Court of Appeals, the rights of all the parties were fixed. The rights to damages, the rights to recovery were all fixed as of that time. American National investigated the case, tried to resolve it. 2.5 years later, the legislature changed the rules. They changed the rules and said the law that was in effect on the date of this accident, the one that vested certain rights in you, is now being changed. We're changing it 2.5 years later, and we're making it retroactive. And you can't do anything about it. You are now being told that the rules that were in effect when this accident happened are being changed. And American National and many amicus who have joined in this appeal think that is not only unfair, that it is unconstitutional.
Well, one thing is that sometimes things that are not fair or that you don't like are unconstitutional, and other things that are unfair are constitutional. Now, your position, as I understand it, is that that retroactive laws per se are not unconstitutional. Is that right?
I'm not here to address retroactive laws per se. I've not made a study of that.
Okay. So there can be retroactive laws, and they can be constitutional.
I believe the court has said that under narrow circumstances, this court has said under narrow circumstances, a law applied retroactively, which changes substantive rights, can withstand constitutional scrutiny. And in the Knoll case, you said it took something like a national emergency, like a war or a national disaster, to uphold the retroactive law.
I know. And the state's amicus brief indicates that the Knoll dissent was accepted in Martin v. Richard. Is that right?
That's what they say, yes.
You agree with that?
Well, I agree that perhaps the way of looking at the analysis was adopted in Martin versus Richards, but Martin versus Richards also held unconstitutional the retroactive change in damage limits. I don't believe that there's any comfort that can be taken either from Knoll or Martin. Both of them said a retroactive change to damage limits such a change is unconstitutional.
But in Martin versus Richards, it set out this quote balancing test.
So
I think that's what at least I'm going to ask you to talk about, because the court is going to be obviously doing that, balancing your client's rights, public versus the private rights. And just one other question before you get into that or move on, and that is, it seems to me that as far as your policy is concerned, the policy of your American National, you're restricted to those policy limits. Nothing changed. It's just that the limits on the policy remain the same.
Absolutely. The limits stay the same. It's the law that changed.
The law that changed.
Right. Yes, Justice Abramson, talking about fairness, the reason I brought up the issue of fairness is because that was one of the tests raised in Martin of whether the change is fair or not. And I think it's fair to address, no pun intended, fair to address that issue of whether the change is in fact fair or not. And Justice Wilcox, addressing your question, Martin did adopt a different way of looking at these cases, at least in my mind. And Martin, of course, was the exact opposite situation we have here. In that case, they put a cap on or lowered the amount that could be recovered in a medical malpractice case. Here, the cap was in effect raised. And I don't know the reason. I've tried to square the cases that came before Martin, the Keeley, the Quinn, the Bradley, and the Knoll case, all of which said flatly that this kind of retroactive change in rights of recovery is unconstitutional, which with Martin, which also said the same thing, a retroactive change in the right of, or amount of recovery is unconstitutional. But Martin looked at it in a different way. And if that means that this court from now on looks at things from a balancing point of view, adopting the Martin test, then I guess we will have to deal with that, and I'm ready to discuss that. But there is clear precedent, four cases, all of which flatly state from this court that a retroactive change in the wrongful death context, in three of those four cases, and one in an unemployment compensation context, a retroactive change in the amount of recovery or the right of recovery is unconstitutional. This, the Court of Appeals, and this is the only case in the Court of Appeals I'll cite today, is the Huff case, said flatly, a legislature may not constitutionally enact a law impairing existing rights acquired under prior law. There's no question in this case that American National acquired vested rights as of the time of the accident. That is what has been explained to us in case after case that has come out of this court. Probably most strongly stated in the Knoll case, that rights that are in effect at the time an accident occurs are substantive rights and they are vested rights. And people who hold those substantive and vested rights may not lose them by subsequent change in the legislative process. No matter how well-intentioned that legislative decision or legislative enactment may be, there may be great motives for this legislation, but it impairs vested, existing, and substantive rights to use the language of the court.
Isn't the question whether they are vested?
I'm sorry?
Isn't the question whether they are vested? I mean, when you say something is vested, then that's a legal conclusion that brings forth the consequences, which is you can't take them away without due process of law.
Right.
So the real issue is, should they be considered vested so that you can't take them away? I mean, that was the issue. That was the issue in Knoll, and that was the distinction between the majority and the dissent. And isn't that the issue in Martin?
Well, this court in Knoll said, and I'm quoting, the general rule is that a statute dealing with substantive rights cannot affect rights vested on its effective date. And I suppose one might argue that the substantive rights were not necessarily vested, although I think in Martin the court talked about the rights of victims of malpractice, and if it didn't use the term, those rights were vested. In fact, I think in a footnote it said we saved that term for another day. Certainly implied that they were vested rights. Certainly said those people who were the victims of malpractice when the malpractice occurred had the right to unlimited damages, and the legislature may not take that away from them and apply it retroactively. The same rule has to apply to American National in this case, that the right to know exactly how much your exposure is, what your liability is, because the statute says that's what it is. That the damage amount, that is a vested right, which every citizen holds who abides by the law that's in effect when the accident takes place.
Mr. Moore, let's assume for a minute that this court is going to look at this case in the light of the Martin versus Richards test. What are the arguments on your side, the arguments that favor a finding that retroactive application is unconstitutional?
Well, the Martin test, if we're going to use a balancing test, says we have to compare the private rights that have been lost against the public good that is to be enhanced, and that we also consider fundamental fairness. So let's take a look then at the private rights. And I, again, it's hard to talk about the private right without talking about a person or a citizen having a vested right in the law as it exists at the time the event takes place. I believe in that so fundamentally that maybe I'm missing a point here, but all of the cases have talked about that is the law that existed when it happened. Everyone is entitled to know what that law is. In Snopek, this court said that the reason we don't make things retroactive is that as a matter of justice, no law should be enforced before people learn of its existence and conduct themselves accordingly. Retroactivity disturbs the stability of past transactions. That's the private right, that fundamental notion that goes back into the common law. There's a nice quotation at the beginning of the amicus brief filed by the Civil Trial Council of Wisconsin that traces that notion back even before the common law, that private right, the right to know and to live by and to be regulated by the laws that are in effect when the incident occurs, that's the fundamental right. Now, against that right, that private right, or that right that is being lost by all private citizens.
What is being lost? I'd like you to continue.
The loss is that the rules have changed, that I know what my exposure is when an accident happens. I know how I should conduct myself. I know how much insurance I should buy.
What does that mean in practical effect to your client? I think that's what Justice Crooks is.
Well, the practical effect to my client is its exposure went up five times. The amount it would have been required to pay had we not settled with Mr. Gazurevich's client, it almost tripled. It went from $150,000 to $500,000. I guess that's more than tripling. That's the practical effect to my client. Is instead of having to pay $150,000, it faced an exposure of $500,000. As applied to the facts of the case, the exposure went from $50,000 to $250,000 because of some reducing clauses in underlying insurance. So that's the practical effect of my client. It's either a 3 or a 5-time exposure on what it had to pay.
Counsel, is your argument then that your client, kind of citing that Snopek language, lost the right to rely on the law as it existed at the time?
It was deprived of its right to rely on the law, yes, or lost it.
Doesn't that, if that's the right, then doesn't it logically extend to having a rule that would prohibit retroactivity? Because retroactivity by its nature changes the law as it existed in the past.
Certainly in this context, the law has, in my understanding, the law is retroactive laws are prohibited. They are. The Knoll case says we can carve out an exception for that, and I can quote the language if you want me to read it, says that there can be an exception. And it's, quote, there was no emergency or catastrophe present in this case, such as a war. The Knoll case says in emergency situations or catastrophic situations, we can make laws like this retroactive. But in no other cases can we. That's my understanding of the law, that you can't do it. Justice Crooks, I didn't mean to get away from your example. I want to get back to what we balance against this private right that is lost here. And the respondent in this case has advanced three arguments. This is the public good, they say, and it's their burden now to show that there is a great public good that needs to be served. The legislature in Martin thought that the great public good was to put a cap on runaway malpractice verdicts, and this court said that's not good enough. Here's the public good that they advanced. They advanced three arguments. First, that that tort victims' ability to recover full damages will be enhanced. Now, bear in mind, this law, as it's being applied, does not apply to all tort victims. It applies to only those who had cases pending during this three-year, or who had cases occurred during this three-year window, and who didn't otherwise settle or resolve their case before the law became effective. And that's a pretty narrow group of people. It is not the general public. And those people, by waiting, are going to get, or hope to get, increased compensation. But their increased compensation is no more full compensation than the compensation that was available to victims of wrongful death before the legislature made its change. Wrongful death is a creation of statute. And the statute has always said, here's what you can recover for loss of society and companionship. It's been 25, it's been 50. At the time of this law, it was 150,000. That's full compensation, the legislature has said, and you are entitled to that. To say that those people didn't get full compensation when the legislature said they did get full compensation is just wrong. The legislature has changed the definition of full compensation now and says it's either 350 or 500,000. That does not mean that the people who got 150 didn't get full compensation. And to say that the law is necessary so that tort victims get full compensation in this context is wrong. And that's not a public benefit that warrants a retroactive application. The second reason they advance is they say a retroactive application will deter negligence. And this one, with all due respect, I think this is just plain wrong. How a retroactive application of this law can deter the negligence that took place 2.5 years before the law was in effect is absolutely beyond me. The law cannot possibly deter negligence that has already occurred. It is impossible, logically impossible. The third reason they advance, and these are the only three, is that the change in the law is necessary to help members of the public get lawyers. Now, I'm not sure that is a public function, but assuming for the sake of argument that it is a public function, the Nymans had an attorney. All of these cases that are pending, they all have attorneys. There is no public need here to increase, maybe to increase the cap. There is no need to make it retroactive so that these people can get lawyers. All of these people have lawyers. These cases that are pending now, and you know there are many of them waiting for this decision, they all have attorneys.
Let's
and so there is
back.
No public, no growing public need to make it retroactive so that people can get lawyers. I'm sorry, Justice.
But you agree, maybe you don't, but do you agree that increasing the amount recoverable does give people access to justice by allowing them to get lawyers?
I think at the margin there are some cases, yes, which because the amount recoverable will increase, will get lawyers. I think that's a small percentage, but I would agree with you that as an intellectual matter, there will be some cases that will be brought because the amount recoverable is greater.
And your second argument about the public policy of increasing the damages may have an effect of decreasing medical malpractice. Do you agree with that?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your
question. Well, your second public policy argument was if you increase the allowable damages, you would decrease malpractice.
I wasn't talking about malpractice. It was deterring negligence.
Okay, negligence.
Okay.
Talk about negligence.
I cannot understand why a retroactive law will deter negligence that occurred in the past.
I understand your point about retroactivity, but just as a general point, if it weren't retroactive for the future, would it deter negligence?
I think it would have the tendency to deter negligence, just as any tort recovery does. Right, increased amount. It would certainly cause me to go out and get more insurance. I will agree with that.
And perhaps have people that have opportunity to supervise others on negligence that take more care.
In the future, yes.
Okay.
Yes, as a general rule, I think that's probably a true statement.
The reason I'm asking that is that in that sense, it differs from the Martin case where some of the public policy arguments were irrelevant, whether it was retroactive or in the future, according to the court.
Yeah. That may be true. I only, because Justice Crooks asked about it, I comment on those three claimed areas of public concern which were advanced to justify the retroactive application. I'm not here challenging the increase in limits. I'm here challenging the retroactive application. None of those three is, in my mind, served by a retroactive application of the law. That is, and it is certainly not a great public need that needs to be satisfied to justify the enactment of a retroactive law. This court in Noel says it has to be a significant public emergency that has to be present in order to justify invading vested rights, disenfranchising people from vested rights.
Counsel, I haven't read all of these underlying cases, but I'm looking at the Attorney General's brief. And in response to Now, several times you've suggested national emergency, war.
That's because that's what's in Noel. Yeah.
And the response to your argument in part on that would be set forth on pages 6 and 7 of the Attorney General's brief. And there the brief argues that, look, there are several examples, and they cite usury, the Supreme Court case upheld retroactive imposition of substantial financial liability upon whole operators for the disabilities of former employees. They cite Gray for the proposition of a retroapplication of a requirement that employees contribute to a pension plan upon withdrawal from the plan. They cite Landgraf, and it seems that these cites are all for the premise that, look, as long as the legislature clearly evinces an intent for retroactivity, and the record demonstrates that the legislature, here Congress, has affirmatively considered the potential unfairness and done the balancing test between the promotion of public interest and the impairment of private interests, when you have those, the clear evincing of intent and a demonstration of the balancing done by the legislature, that the court should refuse to second-guess the legislature's judgment. Is the Attorney General properly citing these cases for that conclusion and premise, or can you distinguish these and respond?
I have not read, and I'm not able to discuss the U.S. Supreme Court cases.
Yeah, I haven't read them either.
Yeah. I will comment, though, in response to your question, to say this, that this court has quite clearly held that a retroactive change in a existing right, the right of recovery, the right of damages can be awarded, is unconstitutional. That was the holding in the Noel case. Now, if that retroactive application is on its face unconstitutional, then it does not matter, I would submit, how much the legislature has looked at this, how intentionally they want this thing to be retroactive, what studies they may have done, or how well-intentioned they are. They cannot disenfranchise people of vested rights, and it doesn't matter if they intend to do that or not. The effect is still the same. And
The Landgraf, and again, I know we're both at this disadvantage, is cited for the premise that Congress has the constitutional power to retroactively affect substantive rights as long as Congress evinces the intent and balances and its rationale. But I'm not sure that's correctly cited, but you would disagree with that premise that Congress has the power to retroactively affect substantive rights.
I think what's being discussed there is the so-called rational basis test for looking at whether enactments which are claimed to violate substantive due process are in fact constitutional or not, and the Supreme Court has said time and again that there's a rational basis we will allow the court or legislature to enact such legislation. If you look at page 3 of the Attorney General's brief, it says, though, when a statute under attack neither impinges upon a fundamental right nor burdens a suspect class, the rational basis test applies. My argument would be, we are impinging on a fundamental right here. You cannot apply the rational basis test. This court has already gone on record as saying that this is a vested substantial right, and it cannot be taken away without violating the Wisconsin Constitution and therefore the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution.
Well, isn't in effect Martin v. Richards applied a rational basis test?
No, I don't think so. The rational basis test, and I'm not a constitutional scholar to talk about that in the context of retroactive legislation. I know the rational basis test has been applied to determining whether it's proper for a legislature to enact a class of individuals who will receive certain treatment, or a class of business that will receive certain treatment. And if there's a rational basis, that distinction can be made. I don't think it applies to retroactive legislation which disenfranchises people of vested rights. That's my take on this whole subject. Martin versus Richards looked and balanced the public right, the public issues to be accomplished, the public good to be done, versus the private rights that are being impaired. And Martin versus Richards said there were a lot of public goods here that applied to a lot of people. Here it doesn't. It applies to a very narrow group of people, and the reasons being advanced why this legislation must be made retroactive simply don't wash. They are not major public concerns. In fact, most of them do not logically respond to the retroactivity. That is, the deterring of the negligence, the getting of lawyers, and of course the notion of full, what is full compensation when we're talking about a right of recovery that is purely a function of statute. Justice Bradley, if you haven't read those underlying cases we talked about, the Keeley case, the Quinn case, the Bradley case, and the Noel case. It is an unbroken string, all of which say, and it concludes with Noel, and I can read you some of the language from this court in Noel. A legislature may not constitutionally enact a law which impairs vested rights acquired under prior law, nor may it enact retrospective laws creating new obligations with respect to past transactions. I mean, that hits it on the head. Any law which attempts to change those rights and obligations after the date of injury is unconstitutional. The amount of compensation benefits is determined according to the law as of the date of the injury. To give the law the effect argued for by the state, to use your question, would retroactively affect the obligations of the employers already set by law and would be a violation of Article 1, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution.
So your position is Noel and Martin are consistent.
Yes.
We just use different language, but they are consistent.
They are consistent, in my opinion. We have the same situation with Martin, except the roles are reversed here.
And your position, I assume, is that Martin really didn't have to go through all of this analysis. It just should have cited Noel and said, look, they had a vested interest, a vested right in an unlimited recovery, and you can't retroactively decrease that vested right, no.
With all due respect, I agree. I don't think Martin had to go through that and that different way of looking at it to come to the same conclusion. I think even if we have to apply, in this case, the Martin balancing test, the law still doesn't meet the standard.
Thank you. Counsel. We will now hear from... You're going to have to pronounce your name for me, sir. Thank you, Mr. Gastrokevich. You represent Christopher Newman et al. Newman et al.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here as well, Mr. Moore, Justices of the Court. I represent and was proud to represent the Nymans who are present in the courtroom here today, Your Honor. The appellant, ANPAC's position is that their due process challenge rests upon its claim that it was deprived of a property interest by the retroactive application of the Wisconsin Act 89, raising the limits of recovery to $500,000 for loss of society companionship of a minor child. The purpose of the wrongful death statute in this state is to provide a remedy for tort victims, not to convey rights to tortfeasors who negligently caused someone's death. ANPAC is not a victim. ANPAC is not a tortfeasor. ANPAC is the Nyman's own insurance company providing underinsurance motorist coverage in this case. ANPAC's property interest or legal claim of entitlement in this due process challenge is based upon the contract it has with the Nymans. Therefore, ANPAC's right is limited to its liability arises from its contract, not the wrongful death statute. ANPAC's theory of entitlement under this contract theory collides directly with the settled law of this state with respect to the scope of the state's police power. Police power enables the legislature to establish parameters of economic relationships, even to the extent of altering existing contractual relationships. The obligation of contract is not an absolute right. but is one that may be obliged to yield to compelling interests of the public, the exercise of the police power. Our court has cited in Chappie versus Lurk, a U.S. Supreme Court case in Allied Structural Steel Corporation, which Justice Bradley talked about a little bit earlier with respect to the U.S. Supreme Court decisions. There's a very important quote in that case which I'd like to read. It says, "It is the settled law of this court that the interdiction of statutes impairing the obligations of contracts does not prevent the state from exercising such power as was vested in it for promotion of the common weal or necessary for the general good of the public, though contracts previously entered into between individuals may thereby be affected. This power is known as the police power and is paramount to any rights under contract with individuals." I must respectfully disagree with Mr. Moore with respect to his analysis of what we call the trilogy case, the Keeley, the Quinn, the Bradley case, all of which, by the way, were never an invocation of the police power by the legislature. When we talk to the cases of Briggs and Stratton and Knoll, I do believe that in the case of Martin versus Richards, that the accepted the dissent analysis that was portrayed in the Knoll case. But this court, in those cases, in Briggs and Stratton in 1981, in Chappie versus Lurk in 1987, and in Martin versus Richards in 1995, set out a standard for the legislature to use when it is going to challenge or look at the constitutionality of using its police power for retroactivity. It gave a hornbook guideline for the legislature. In Briggs versus Knoll, we talked about the nature and strength of the public interest versus the unfairness created by the retroactive application of the statute. We talked about the police power of the state being utilized in the Briggs and Stratton versus Knoll case. And what the court looked at there was the specific legislative intent. And I believe the reason that didn't pass muster in the Knoll case was the specific legislative intent that was articulated in that case was the legislature was trying to make up for not passing a bill before the end of the preceding year. It did not invoke the police power or the elements of the police power that were required to bring that into retroactivity. In Chappie, again, another test that was brought out was, is there a legitimate legislative purpose that's furthered by a rational means in retroactive application of statutes? That was another workers' compensation case. But Chappie stood for other identification key markers by this court to the legislature. Chappie said that the legislative public purpose to invoke police power need not be an emergency. It need not be to the caliber of a war or catastrophe, which Mr. Moore is now proffering to the court. Chappie said, this police power may be used by the legislature to remedy a broad and general social and economic problem that exists. The court in Chappie went on to cite from Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation versus R.A. Gray, a 1984 U.S. Supreme Court case, the following. Legislative acts adjusting the burdens and benefits of economic life come to the court with a presumption of constitutionality, and the burden is on the complaining party, the complaining of due process violation, to establish that the legislature has acted in arbitrary and irrational way. It is not my burden, as Mr. Moore says to this court, to establish the constitutionality of that. It is his burden to establish the unconstitutionality of this act by the legislature.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
Let me pose a hypothetical to you to get it out of the realm of an insurance company and into the realm of an individual. Let's assume that sometime back in the early 90s, I purchased automobile insurance And I made inquiry as to what the wrongful death limits were, and found out that they were $150,000. So I insured myself for that amount to make sure that if I was involved in an accident, $150,000 would not come out of my pocket, it would come out of my insurance policy. Then the exact same things happen. I mean, there's an accident in 1995, there's a death, and my insurance company pays out $150,000, the limits of the policy. Then the legislature goes and does this and increases that limit to, what, $500,000, is that it, or something like that. Now the person that the parties that recovered from my insurance policy, from my insurance company, come to me, and they say, we want, since this court, if you prevail, the Supreme Court said that this is retroactive, and therefore, instead of the $150,000 that I had that they had coming, they've got $500,000 coming. Pay up, Bablitch. And I say, hey, I thought I had insured myself, the legislature, with sufficient funds. And now you're going to apply a law to me that was not in effect in 1995, and I'm going to have to come up out of my own pocket with $350,000. If I had known the legislature was going to retroactively apply it, I would have insured myself. How do you respond to that?
Two ways. First of all, I'm assuming by your hypothetical that it still falls within the applicable statute of limitations, so that you are
all
legally
the facts are the same, except now all of a sudden I'm involved.
I distinguish it by the state making a compelling public policy decision under the police power that the limits that we set at $150,000 were so ridiculously low that they did not create a fulfillment in the people that were the injured parties who brought the action. That Bablitch was the one who was the tortfeasor here. That if someone should, from a public policy standpoint, in exercise of the police power, and for the common good, we decide that perhaps Bablitch takes a financial hit for creating an injury that injured and killed someone, then so be it. That's an individual negative juxtaposed to the common good of the entire state.
Okay, but then my response is, I would have insured myself for $500 if I had known that the legislature could go and do this, or if I could have had a crystal ball and I would have been told back in 1992 when I purchased this policy that I didn't get enough insurance. How do you respond to that?
I guess my answer to that is that there's ample case law that if you believe that creates some minor unfairness or inequity,
I wouldn't consider $350,000 a minor unfairness.
I think that you can have those types of situations and not have a law fail for due process constitutional arguments.
Counsel,
when you look at the whole.
Are you saying it doesn't matter whether it's an individual or whether it's American family as a constitutional issue?
I am not. They are a person for all intents and purposes, Your Honor.
So whether it's an individual or it's a corporation, both have due process rights.
Exactly.
And you don't see a difference.
I see no difference with respect to the eyes of this court looking at it, no.
And the cases don't show a difference between
they do not.
Okay. So his example is the same as this case?
His example would be I do believe, Your Honor, all we are asking for, the Nymans are asking, are for the totality of the policy limits in which they had. It was $250,000. It was not $500,000. They did get access to a reducing clause, so they paid $50,000, so it's $100,000 that's really at issue here, Your Honor. So it's not the $350,000 hit that you believe it might be. But
the amount of money is really irrelevant.
I understand.
It could be $1 million.
I agree with the court.
It couldn't because the statute limits it, but it doesn't matter whether the American family would be out $350,000 or $500,000 if it was a deceased minor, etc. It's not the amount, is it?
No, it would not be the amount in terms of this court's analysis of the situation, no.
Okay.
I agree.
If this were happening to you, wouldn't you say, gee, this is unfair?
I would, Your Honor. I would say that it's unfair, and I would hate like heck to pull into my savings or my pocketbook to pay that kind of money, but I would be satisfied that the common good of the state and that the legislature was looking to the common good of the totality of Wisconsinites and saying that this is just and fair compensation, even if it's retroactive. I could live with that.
You can see a lot of mischief, excuse me, Counselor, that could be done under the quote common good when there's a reliance and there has been a precedential reliance. Now, I was here when Martin versus Richards became common law of the state, but I think that the common sense understanding is that people say, look, you know, that wasn't the law then. And you're saying, well, yeah, but it's the common good. And I mean, a lot of danger is in that concept.
Well, but I think the Martin versus Richard test protects the individual from unfairness because there is a balancing, that is the court's function, and I think that is the court's function here today, is to use the test that was delineated in Martin, in which would, you know, the way the public interest served by the retroactive application of the statute against the private interests that are overturned by it. That's the very issue that I think that Justice Babbage articulated in the Martin decision, and which he's now asked me. It's his private interest, but you do have to compare that against a compelling and real public interest that exists and that the legislature sought, utilized, and used to invoke the police power to act to this.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
This terrible accident occurred on September 5th, 1995.
That's correct, sir.
The people who can take advantage of the new law have to have filed a suit, I assume, on or after April 28th, 1998. Is that right?
Yes.
What about the people who filed suit, say, in 1997 for an accident the same day? How does this law affect them?
I'm not following you, sir.
Those people, I mean, the accident, let's say an accident occurred on exactly the same day, 10 places around the state. And people filed their lawsuit before April 28th, 1998. They're not able to take advantage of the law, are they?
They would not be able to, no.
Is that fair?
I don't believe that's unfair. You know, if we would do that, we would never make any changes in the law. That would never apply. I think that in this case, the legislature determined, as was articulated in Chappie, for a rational means to apply this retroactivity. They applied it retroactively to a specific period of time of people who were not yet compensated for their injuries, for their losses from wrongful death. I think the court has to understand how the genesis of this bill was two mothers who suffered loss of their children at the hands of medical negligence, who couldn't get to court, who were outraged by the low limits of the value that the legislature had placed on the life of their child. They, at a grassroots effort, came to the legislature and said, look, we need to change this. This is not fair. And then the legislature heard that. The legislature heard the pain of these people. They decided to do something, but they didn't do it in haste. They had legislative hearings. They had the legislative staff attorney advise them of the constitutional ramifications of retroactive application. And they were mindful of what they were doing when they passed this retroactive application. And I think when they did that, they satisfied the terms not only of Martin, but of Chappie in applying a means for the populace of this state, a manner in which we can go back, but yet accommodate those people which we now believe raise to invocation of the state's police power.
Counsel,
One of the concerns I have is how subjective this is, how arguably subjective is the this balancing test. And it seems to me that the legislature can, as long as they make a record, that is, showing that different interests came and spoke and that they considered things, as long as they make a record that looks like they're balancing interests, and as long as that their conclusion seems like a good idea to us, we'd vote for it, seems fair to me, then you can affect the rights that previously existed in people. I mean, it just seems so squishy. Your opposing counsel gives a less squishy test. Your opposing counsel says, look, these are vested rights. These are my rights. And unless you have the war, unless you have something very, very, very severe, I mean, that's more predictable for me. That's more concrete for me, and part of our job is predictability, and people rely on the law. The other test seems so amorphous, so unreviewable. If we like it, fine. If we don't, then it's not good. Can you respond to that?
Yeah. Justice William O. Douglas said of the U.S. Supreme Court, we do not sit as a super legislature. We do not challenge, you know, what the legislature's decision process was. This court in Chappie stated as follows, if the retroactive application of a statute is supported by a legitimate legislative purpose, furthered by rational means, judgments about the wisdom of such legislation remain within the exclusive province of the legislature and executive branches, not for this court.
But Martin then introduces this fairness. So doesn't that make us the super legislature?
No, I don't
believe the legislature can do anything, I mean, and I'm not advocating that. The legislature can do anything it wants. We think it's fair, it's constitutional. We think it's unfair, it's unconstitutional. That's a pretty slippery slope.
I don't believe it's as slippery as Justice Bradley believes it is.
I think there
is articulated reasons in the legislative history. That was why we placed the legislative history in front of Judge Wagner Malloy. That's why we've placed it in part of our brief. That's why it's been identified here. This was not something that was done by the legislature at a blind whim or without thoughtful process or without understanding that it may be challenged by this court and to identifying and articulating all those fairness issues. And in balance, the legislature said that this was fair to retroactively apply. It was fair to affect previously entered contractual obligations with an individual or an insurance
But doesn't the Martin test then say, regardless what the legislature says in their balancing, if we think it's fair, am I misconstruing the Martin test? Don't we impose our sense of fairness on the whole thing, too?
I don't believe that the Martin test, and certainly Justice Babbage, who wrote it, can tell me if I'm wrong here, said that that's what ought to be done. I don't think that this court meant in the Martin test that they second-guess the legislature. They can look at the public interest served versus the private interest that's affected, but I don't think they second-guess the legislature's determination there. And I think what you look for is to see whether or not the legislature had a reasonable discussion or intellectual discussion about whether or not there ought to be this change retroactively. That was the deficiency that existed in Briggs and Stratton versus Knoll. You know, the dissent was compelling in that case that, you know, this was a sufficient public policy to change the law retroactive, but it didn't prevail on that day. One of the things I did want to discuss with the court was that in this situation, there was the legislature was faced with a grassroots effort, but was also faced with the fact that these women came to the legislature and asked for review. That at that time, 44 states were without any caps on this. All of the neighboring states to the state of Wisconsin had no limits on caps for loss of society and companionship. That we were tied with the lowest in the nation, with New Hampshire and Maine at the time. That the legislature then had hearings, public hearings, one of which Mr. Moore attended. That they talked about the balancing of the private interest. They came up with a rational test, and only after that deliberation did they then retroactively pass 1997 Wisconsin Act 89. And I think what's important here also is to look at the executive branch's imprimatur of this law. The executive branch's statement also reiterates the public policy served by this law. And under Wisconsin case law, what Governor Thompson said in the public statement is part of the legislative history and also evidence of legislative intent. Now, Governor Thompson stated when he signed this bill that it was retroactive in application, that the law addressed the pursuit of tort reform needed in this state, the effect of settlements that drive up consumer costs, of insurance and health care in the legal system against providing a fair and equitable system of relief for Wisconsin families, retroactively as well as prospectively. And the governor, as the third branch of government, an executive branch, blessed this law. It was dubbed the Justin Lindsay Bill. It was named again after Lindsay Brooke Schultz and Justin Sky Miller, two children who died at the hands of medical negligence. Governor Thompson finished by saying, "Today we make sure that families like Lindsay's and Justin's have the opportunity to pursue fair compensation for their losses. Just such a family is the Nymans." Granted, Justice Prosser, there will be some families who settled their cases, who resolved their cases, who will not have that opportunity. But the law is a progressive vote. And with that, Your Honor, I have nothing further.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Moore?
All of the arguments that were presented for the change in the law, inadequate compensation, lack of some cases being brought to court are, of course, good and legitimate reasons why the law could be changed and changed prospectively. There was not one argument advanced why the law had to be changed retroactively. The only case cited by respondent and, in fact, the amicus who filed on the respondent's side is this Chappie case, and I want to talk about it briefly. Chappie, as the court will recall, specifically involved a change in the past law, but only as it affected future transactions. It did not affect past transactions, and the court specifically said it was a de minimis change in the law. The amount at issue was only $1,100. The court, in concluding, said the present case involves a de minimis impairment of the insurance company's rights. This court has never held that a de minimis impairment raises a constitutional question, and we decline to do so in this case. But in the context of the Chappie case, this court discussed the kind of broad emergency or broad
public requirement that is necessary to invoke the police power. That's what they're asking. They're asking that this court permit the invocation of the police power for a retroactive law without giving us any compelling public reason why it had to be done so. In Chappie, this court said, if the legislation constitutes a substantial impairment, there must exist a significant and legitimate public purpose behind the legislation. It should be directed towards remedying a broad and general social or economic problem. That is not what occurred in this case. This is a relatively small number of pending lawsuits that that are being made retroactive and depriving existing citizens of substantial rights. Justice Bablich hit it absolutely on the head, and a great example of cross-examination when Mr. Gazarkevich admitted in response to the question, is that fair? And he said, no, that's not fair. That's exactly what's going on. When Justice Prosser over here asked, what about all those people who started their lawsuits within the 2.5 years before this law became effective and settled for the lower amount? Is this fair to them that some who waited should get more for exactly the same set of circumstances? That's not fair either. The test is, and it goes back to the questions were raised by Justice Bablich, how am I to know how I should order my life if the legislature is going to come along and change things and make it retroactive, change the rules after I have relied on the law that existed at the time? And in Snopek, I want to just read this language again. Strong common law tradition defines the legislature's primary function as declaring law to regulate future behavior. Thus, as a matter of justice, or Justice Bradley, as a matter of fairness, to use your term. Thus, as a matter of justice, no law should be enforced before people learn of its existence and conduct themselves accordingly. In short, retroactivity disturbs the stability of past transactions. That's exactly what's going on in this case. However well-meaning the legislature may be, however well-grounded their decision was in increasing those limits for future events that occur, they may not trample on the existing rights. It is not fair to the people who ordered their lives in reliance on what the law was. It is not fair to those people who settled their cases on the basis of what the law was. It is not a great public and social emergency that has to be addressed that requires the invocation of the police power. We would respectfully request that this statute, insofar as it is being applied retroactively, be declared to be unconstitutional and the judgment of the trial court be reversed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for presenting the argument. That ends the hearing on 99-2554. The court is in recess until 1:45 p.m. And the students and anyone else who wishes should stay and...